Okay, but what happens after a debt limit deal? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today. This one is the first day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are, if the Senate of the United States does its job right, days, mere hours, if we're lucky, from not having to utter the words debt limit for another 2 years. Yes, there are votes yet to cast, but assuming, with all the peril that assuming implies, that the debt limit deal gets done, we should be good. Right? Let me give you a very firm probably on that, because the Treasury Department's going to have to make up for lost time and raise a whole lot of cash real quick, which means some big moves in the debt markets. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
When the U.S. hit its debt ceiling back in January, it was basically like the national credit card was cut off. So since then, the government has been using the national debit card, paying cash, not borrowing. Funds are now running very low.
The Treasury Department has to replenish their checking account, basically.
George Mateo is chief investment officer at Key Private Bank. Right now, he says there's around $37 billion in the Treasury general account. On the day we hit the debt ceiling, there was more than $450 billion. So the government has to sell a lot of treasuries to make that up.
In addition to that, they have to repay some of these extraordinary measures that they took out.
Extraordinary measures is the Treasury borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, delaying investments in government employee retirement funds, moving money from one agency to another just to pay the bills. All of that is another $270 billion the Treasury needs to raise. So the grand total for how much the government needs to bring in is...
in the trillion-dollar neighborhood over the next 3 to 6 months. So it's a substantial amount.
Jonah Crane is a partner with Claros Group. So what happens when the government needs to sell $1 trillion worth of treasuries and do it fast? The money people are going to use to buy them has to come from somewhere. Some analysts worry about that money coming out of bank accounts, which could be bad for banks.
I think what people worry about is that could affect the economy.
Kathy Jones is chief fixed income strategist at the Charles Schwab Center for Financial Research.
If the money comes from banks, then that might mean that, you know, we have less reserves in the banking system and less willingness to lend, and less willingness to lend means a slower economy.
Jones says this fear is overblown, and so does Eric Winograd, chief economist at Alliance Bernstein.
There's plenty of liquidity available to buy these T-bills.
Over at the Federal Reserve, banks have special accounts where they put their extra cash.
Banks have parked more than $2 trillion in that account.
And a lot of the money that investors have not been able to put into treasuries recently has gone instead into something called money market funds. There's another several trillion in there, and some of it could pretty easily just be used to buy up treasuries. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money, right? Whatever debt limit Soros equities had is all but gone. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been a while since we pointed out that a lot, maybe all, actually, of the big-name economic indicators we get are lagging. That is, they tell us what happened, not what's coming. Today, for instance, we got first-time claims for unemployment benefits for last week, up just a touch, by the way. Yesterday, we got JOLTS. I mentioned that on the program, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, from which we learned that the rate at which people are leaving their jobs, the quits rate, it's called, for April was down, basically back to where it was in 2019. That is the data, the science, the lagging data. The art of covering this economy is trying to figure out what the quits rate can tell us about where the economy might be headed. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab got that assignment this morning.
The past couple years have been pretty busy for Edouard Tumir. He's managing partner at Acura Recruiting Services, which works in retail, hospitality, and travel.
Demand for new talent was very, very high. and candidates were very heavily solicited from every direction. So it was definitely like an employee-driven market.
In the last 6 months, he's noticed a change.
There are fewer employers looking to hire, and candidates are not as open to make moves. They are definitely like cautious.
Cautious, perhaps, because of the economy. Typically, the quits rate helps economists gauge how confident people feel about retiring or finding a new job or quitting and living off a savings cushion.
And the pandemic really put those on steroids for a couple of years.
Erica Groshen is a labor economist at Cornell. She says the labor market has seen so much disruption between the beginning of the pandemic and now. Workers were swiftly laid off, then desperately needed. People moved states, looked for remote jobs, wanted more money. That wage growth part has been cooling in recent months, and a lower quits rate could be a sign of even more cooling to come, says Harvard economist Jason Furman.
One of the main reasons you give your workers a raise is that you're afraid they're going to quit and go someplace else.
When the quits rate goes down, so does wage growth and the growth in the cost of goods and services. So if wage growth is what's driving inflation, that could be a good thing. But there's a caveat, isn't there always?
Job openings remain very high. There are about 1.8 job openings for every unemployed worker.
Which means the labor market is still tighter than it was before the pandemic. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Speaking of workers in this economy, as Kristen just was, we started a series a little bit more than 3 years ago, just as the pandemic was hitting, called The United States of Work. 10 workers in this economy who formed kind of a representative sample of the American labor force as a whole. One of those 10 was a guy named Neil Cairns, a bartender in Portland, Oregon, when first we met him, who got laid off as things shut down, and who's had a series of on and off jobs since then, working in an Irish pub, digitizing documents, pest control, to name a couple, and now this.
I am managing a Bricks and Minifigs franchise. We are a new and used Lego store. So Lego has been standardized since the 70s. The bricks have really not changed, which means that there's this massive stockpile of existing toys out there that can still be used, that are still great, some of which are now collector's items. And rather than let those gather dust in an attic or on a shelf, people resell them. So I spend my day talking to people about toys, showing people toys, helping people buy toys, and playing with toys. It's a pretty thriving market. I'm salaried at $45,000, and I get bonuses based on revenue as well. $45,000 in Portland is not generally enough, but the only thing that's been this stable for me has been my disability payments from the VA. I left the Navy in 2013, and this is the first salaried position that I've had. I know what's coming in month after month, and then I'm also paid a bonus on top of what I know is reliably always going to come in. One of the things that has been incredible about coming here is that, so we do workshops here in the shop every weekend, every Sunday. But we had a kid come in for his birthday, and he had made a card thanking all of us in the store by name individually for creating a space where, as he put it, kids who might not always fit in could have a space. That's exactly what I want to be providing out of this place.
Neil Cairns at Bricks and Minifigs. He's up in Portland, Oregon. You go out to dinner or you get a cup of coffee, time cups to settle up. What do? Well, most of us in this country throw on an extra buck or two for a cup of coffee or 18-ish percent for dinner or something, right? It's almost reflexive. But that reflex is being tested in this increasingly automated society. Think self-checkout kiosks or those walk-in beer fridges at stadiums. Do you tip then? Helena Oakes is a political scientist at Lehigh University, where she has studied, among other things, America's tipping culture. Professor Oakes, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This is, in a lot of ways, a behavioral economics thing, right? Because we are, certainly in this country, conditioned to tip when presented with a summary of the bill, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you only think about this ritual in a transactional sense, we can think about it behaviorally, and we can think about it only as an economic practice or a part of our economic system. But there's also a part of this ritual that's very human.
Yeah.
That's the underexplored aspect, and that's the aspect I'd like to talk about today.
Okay, so we take humans out of the equation, as is increasingly happening, right, where you have self-pay kiosks. You can, in an airport or in a convenience store often, or in regular retail establishments now sometimes, you never have to interact with a human, and yet you are prompted to tip at checkout. What happens then inside the consumer's mind? I know what happens in my mind, which I'll tell you later, but what happens, do you suppose?
Well, I suspect that we're all a lot alike, yeah, right? Because most Americans tip, and we tip a lot, right? So adherence to tipping norms in the United States is quite high, and it's highest when we have face-to-face interactions. And right. So when we're being asked to tip and we haven't interacted face-to-face, you know, we're like, wait a minute, who's going to know if I'm a jerk? Because what our interviews told us, you know, we interviewed more than 450 people from across the U.S. in various sectors where people might receive non-standard compensation. The people who receive tips tell us that most of the time people are tipping because they don't want to seem like a jerk. Mm-hmm. And so if you're tipping in an automated process, who knows if you're right. A jerk or not?
Well, so that's kind of where I land, right? I tip because, number one, I've been conditioned to, as you say. Number two, there are human beings somewhere in the chain of me grabbing that sandwich wherever, even if I don't see them. And also, I don't want to be the jerk. And so social pressure is real. But what in the aggregate does it say about us as a society that now it's expected that we tip in almost all situations?
I think it says a lot about the state of inequality. So some people believe that the tipping ritual is a practice that serves a redistributing function.
Mm.
What we find is that people tend to tip people who are more like them. And so that means in those jobs where people might be expected to receive tips, if they do not meet the cultural standard of acceptability or likability, then they are going to be tipped less. And what we also know is that those more vulnerable positions are also tend to be occupied by folks who are less valued in society.
Right. How much does it matter, or does it matter that, you know, when I'm at my local Starbucks and assuming I'm paying in cash, which is increasingly less likely, right, I'm more likely to put, you know, my cash change or a spare couple of bucks into that tip jar on the counter, right? Does it matter that I assume because it's cash that it's going to go to the people right in front of me. Does it matter that with nameless, faceless transactions, we don't actually know where the money goes? We don't see the money.
It does kind of matter. So if we think about this in terms of, you know, are we going to tip robots? I think about my, you know, one of my favorite, there are a lot of great them some places. One of my favorite.
That's a blanket statement. There are a lot of great them some places.
It is a blanket statement, but I stand by it.
Fair enough.
But, you know, the last time I went to one of my favorite them some places, a robot. So we had a server and interacted with the server to submit our order. And then when some of the dishes came on a robot. And I was like, am I supposed to touch this?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to grab this off the thing? So we interacted with several different people in the process of being served. But I had no idea who was getting the tip. So what I did, I asked a person I knew to be an employee and not a manager. And I said, do you receive all of this tip? How much of this tip do you get? You personally, and do then you tip out the bussers, or do you bus yourself? Do you all make the same amount of money?
Yeah.
You know, as far as I can tell, that's the best way I can figure to ensure that tips are going to the folks who deserve it, who are working the hardest for
right,
it.
Right. Alana Oakes is at Lehigh. Professor Oakes, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Coming up,
there's a sense in the real estate community that there is a huge market opportunity.
Class is no longer in session. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 153 today, almost 0.5%, 33,061. The NASDAQ lifted 165 points. That's almost 1.3%, 13,100. The S&P 500, 41 points to the good, 1%, 42.21. We heard from Kristen Schwab about a drop in the quits rate. So looking at some recruitment stocks, eh? Kelly Services grew 1.9%. Manpower Group added 0.7%. Just talked to Alana Oakes about where the money goes when you tip at self-checkout kiosks. So how about some of those related companies? NCR Corporation makes a lot of stuff that goes in those kiosks. The letters, by the way, National Cash Register. NCR rang up 1.2%. Competitor Toast heated up 2.9%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, was in Sweden yesterday talking trade and technology with her European Union counterparts. One big item on the agenda, artificial intelligence, more specifically the regulation thereof. As with a whole lot of other things technological, think data privacy for one, antitrust actions as well, Europe is pretty far ahead of the United States and at least trying to put some guardrails up. And those rules on AI that Europe might come up with for ChatGPT and the like may well end up affecting American consumers, too. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
The EU Parliament is already putting the final touches on the Artificial Intelligence Act. It could become actual law within the next year. Mark Brakel is policy director at the Future of Life Institute, which advocates for AI safety.
One thing there's consensus on is that if you produce something that is a deep fake, something that people could think is real but isn't, you have to label it and say, this is AI.
Creators of AI models, like the type that power ChatGPT, would also have to disclose whether they use copyrighted material to train their systems. Violators of the AI Act could face steep penalties, including fines of up to 4% of a company's revenue. Emphasis on the could.
Enforcement is one of the key questions that are left open.
Part of the reason the EU has moved so fast, this AI legislation was actually introduced in 2021 to ban things like the use of AI in facial recognition software or emotion recognition systems. But Europe has also just historically been quicker to regulate big tech, partly because of geography. Ivirna McGowan is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
A lot of the very large online platforms that would be subject to this regulation are companies that are headquartered in the United States.
While the political influence of Silicon Valley may be an ocean away from Brussels, EU regulations can still impact how American companies operate stateside.
A lot of global companies, if they have to go to such effort to be compliant in Europe, it doesn't really make sense to then have an alternative for different regions.
In other words, if your company is required to watermark AI images in Germany, you might as well also watermark them in California. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
We're almost through college graduation season, maybe another week, 10 days. But for some schools, Cazenovia College in upstate New York, Holy Names University in Oakland, to name just a couple, this year's commencement is the last ever. According to the Department of Education, more than 100 private nonprofit colleges have permanently shut their doors since 2015. They're closing as the population of traditionally college-age Americans declines and is likely to keep on shrinking, something known in the world of higher education as the demographic cliff, the logical extension of which is that even more schools are likely to close. And as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports, in small college towns, a school that's closed leaves a hole in the local economy and often a very big vacant property.
I'm standing in the ballroom of a vacant mansion in Bennington, Vermont. It has high ceilings and windows that look out on the southern Green Mountains. Real estate developer Alan Weissman has a vision for this space.
This is going to be the dining room. So there's an area that used to be the kitchen. We're going to reconstitute it as a kitchen because this was actually used as a college.
Specifically, Southern Vermont College, or SVC. The small liberal arts school called this former estate on a hill home for about 40 years. It closed in 2019. Now, Weissman and his firm want to turn the entire campus into a luxury resort.
Down what used to be the cafeteria, down the hill, we're going to make that a casual dining room. And the gym, we're going to create an event space in and make it look more like a barn and less like a gym.
Weissman has never redeveloped a college campus before, but he says this one is unique.
I think it would be much more difficult if this was purposely built as a college with cinder block dorms and that kind of thing, but it wasn't. This was built as a luxury estate.
Weissman's idea isn't the first one that's been pitched for the SVC campus. First, there was a prep school, then a summer camp, then the local hospital system, which used it for mass COVID testing and vaccinations and still owns it. But if Weissman manages to close his deal and build an upscale resort, that may be the answer for Bennington's empty campus, says town manager Stuart Hurd.
They're renovating everything on the site and putting it into productive use. From my perspective, you can't ask for more than that.
Hurd says it could help fill the economic void left when SVC closed. For years, the college attracted people from outside Vermont. Some became cops, nurses, and government employees. They started businesses and frequented others, like the Elm Street Market, just down the hill from campus.
The college was not only a big source of business, but a source of employees.
Owner Ted Katsumpas says SVC students worked the deli counter for years, but the closure wasn't just an economic blow.
It was probably more emotional. We were very attached. We did a lot of catering. We were always up there. We went to their sporting events. So it was a loss.
But one community's loss can look pretty attractive to another.
There's a sense in the real estate community that there is a huge market opportunity.
Brad Noyes is a vice president at Brailsford and Dunleavy, a consultant group that works with higher ed institutions that downsize. He says the reality is former campuses are at best complex real estate opportunities.
It becomes very challenging if you cannot find a partner or a new institution or a real estate development partner that really can take advantage of the full value of that campus.
What makes that especially hard is the fact that there's a lot of space to fill on an empty campus. That's according to Jane Kolodinsky, a professor of community development and applied economics at the University of Vermont.
Someone has to have vision. They have to have enough resources to think into the future about when, what will happen when this property is redeveloped, and how complicated are the pieces to put together.
pretty complicated. If the four Vermont campuses that have closed since 2019 are any indication, a former Apprentice contestant bought one for $4.5 million with a plan to create a work college that has yet to materialize. A former Obama administration official bought another one, got into a beef with a crypto executive, then pleaded guilty to wire fraud and sold it off for almost $3 million. The third campus was proposed as a senior housing facility, then a waste management company bought it. In Bennington, Vermont, I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I saw this on Bloomberg. Data from the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. They tally, as you might expect for an outplacement firm, the reasons that companies give for laying people off. Far and away this year, the top category is economic conditions, which we all could have guessed. You scan down the list, a couple of spots, though. Companies say 3,900 people this year have lost their jobs because of artificial intelligence. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Just a quick observation about the actual debt limit bill now on the Senate floor. The text, the PDF, is 99 pages long. The actual language lifting the debt limit, they didn't get to that until page 98. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.